Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and tonight, a star. Nothing to do with Cannes and the film festival, but with writing. Oliver Morton is a marvellous writer. And here, I need to tell you a story. Once, when I was at Oxford, he came to stay. I put him in the West Wing, where I was writing my memoirs. I got up early, as usual, to do some chores, leaving Oliver in bed. Next to his room was my typewriter and a manuscript. When I returned, Oliver had risen, spotted my work in progress, read the unfinished page, something about seafood in northern France, and he sat down and continued the narrative, with some particularly vivid stuff about langoustine and the pink stones of the shoreline around Finisterre. I kept the lot in, and it was duly published. Oliver Morton's last book was about mapping Mars. This time it's Eating the Sun, photosynthesis and all that, and it's also about the people who do the research. Oliver Morton is with Michelle Field in ABC in London.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I am interested in scientists as individuals, and I'm also interested in, at a more sort of like philosophical level, at seeing science as something that's done by individuals, of understanding it as both a collective but an individual endeavour. It's all too easy to just look at diagrams of how a photon interacts with a chlorophyll molecule and not get a feeling for that, that the fact that we can understand that is the triumph of individual people making sometimes small, sometimes large contributions. It was one of the things that attracted me to photosynthesis was there are few great names in the history of photosynthesis to people outside that history. It's not like particle physics or evolutionary theory. It doesn't throw up household names. But a bunch of pretty good scientists working pretty hard for most of 100 years made unbelievable progress in the 20th century. And I hope that by giving a few little details of their lives to make them stand out on the page, I hope that that communicates something of that sort of personal achievement that's central to how science progresses.
But you say also that most of the scientists in this field are not driven by heroic efforts to save the world. They're driven simply by trying to understand something.
That's almost always the motivation. I know that many of the people who work in photosynthesis are interested and moved by the big picture, by the idea that understanding photosynthesis might help us develop new solar power systems, such things, but they don't feel that they have to focus their efforts on the thing that's most likely to help that future come about. Instead, they mostly want to focus their efforts on something that comes to really fascinate them, like how do the little protein thingamabobs in membranes in chloroplasts know which way to go when they get to the surface of the membrane. Those sorts of things become big issues for these people. And because you can't really understand the big things without the details, to some extent it has to be that way. I think there are times when it can become slightly frustrating and you think, well, if you'd all just focus your efforts on doing this thing, then maybe we'd actually make some human technological progress at a slightly higher rate. And I think there is actually a case for some of that. But I also think that in general, one has to be very cagey about asking scientists to stop being the curiosity-driven, somewhat quirky people that they actually are.
To understand what is happening now as we see this climate crisis, and you prefer the term crisis as...
I actually like calling it a carbon climate crisis. I like to keep the idea of the carbon in there for two reasons. One is that it's the carbon dioxide and the methane, which is also carbon-bearing, which are doing most of the warming in the atmosphere. The other thing is that you have to remember that we're actually changing the carbon cycle in ways that go, to some extent, beyond just direct greenhouse warming. So, for instance, if you give plants more carbon, they rearrange themselves so that they don't need to lose so much water. And we're actually seeing this in the world at the moment, that because plants use a bit less water because the carbon dioxide level is higher, the world's rivers flow a little bit harder and the world's skies are a little bit drier in some places. And those sorts of things can have large effects. And so you have to remember the carbon cycle is more than just the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at any one time. So that's why I say carbon climate crisis. But I think crisis is a well-chosen word for this.
The book, in fact, has very little about animals or human beings. It is a book about a world that is inhabited by plants. And I was impressed at how different the effect of the carbon situation is on plants and on animals. Air that is fatal to animals is good for plants.
Absolutely. And the worldview of animals is, to a first approximation, correct. I mean, if you think about the world as a set of biogeochemical cycles, and though that's not the only way to think about it, it's quite a useful way to think about it, because given the life on Earth is about 3.8 billion years old, if we weren't recycling everything, then we'd have run out of something by now. So the fact that cycling is central to how life works on the Earth has to be taken as a given. All those cycles are basically independent of animals. Animals play no real role in any of them. Plants play a pretty large role in the carbon cycle, but when it comes down to it, in terms of these basic mechanisms of habitability, the world's mainly about the microbes. Plants are the big exception, but for everything else, nitrogen, sulfur, things like that, it's stuff that you can't even see that runs the world. And yet, a book just about a microbial planet would probably be of even less interest to people than a book that doesn't have humans in it. So, yes, I think there is something to be said, and I think that's about the world as a place that's basically about plants. I think that's why I enjoyed writing the parts of the book that are about the Devonian, when the plants are spreading across the face of continents for the first time in any big way. And you have these big, silent, almost entirely green forests. No flowers, because there are no insects to be turned on by the colour, because there are no pollinating insects at that time. There were insects, but there were no pollinating insects. And I find that idea of a world that's not animal-free, but only animal-light, rather an interesting, slightly spooky one, but maybe spooky in a slightly good way.
But certainly, if we're looking in these fields, I know nothing about them, so you're going to have to explain to us the sciences of exobiology or astrobiology. Mm-hmm. These are other planets where there might be such plant life. Plant life that does not have to incorporate life in a range that we know it.
Absolutely. No, it's one of the more eccentric of the scientists that I talked to in the book put it to me that this question about astrobiology, about other planets, is the biggest question that we currently have it within our grasp to answer. And the question is there an oxygen-rich biosphere around an Earth-like planet elsewhere? And detecting Earth-like planets is something that we can reasonably assume to do within the next 5 years or so. By Earth-like, I mean Earth-sized planets. And having the technology to actually peer into their atmospheres, not to see individual things, but to see what those atmospheres are made out of, that would be something you could reasonably expect in 10 to 20 years. And when you can do that, you can see oxygen. And oxygen is a very important distinguisher here. For a good part of the Earth's history, for about 1.4 billion years or so after the origin of life, there was almost no oxygen at all in the Earth's atmosphere. But once oxygen got into the Earth's atmosphere, it stayed there. And it's a remarkably obvious indicator of the fact that there is life on Earth, because if you just left an oxygen atmosphere lying around without supporting it by going on making fresh oxygen, it would vanish within hundreds of thousands, maybe a few million years. I mean, oxygen is incredibly corrosive, reactive stuff. So the fact that we have oxygen in our atmosphere and also have things like methane or nitrogen, for example, that can react with oxygen shows that that oxygen is being continually produced, and that's the work of the plants. The plants are doing this. They're producing the oxygen all the time, and the balance of oxygen reflects how plants are making it and how mostly the microbes are using it up. So if we were to see an oxygen lines like those we see in our atmosphere in a planet around another star, and if that planet had some other characteristics, because there are ways to make oxygen purely with chemical and physical energy, but I think we probably know enough to rule those out if we see them, then we'd be saying that there's something out there that's photosynthesizing, effectively, because there's no energy source for a planet anything like as abundant as the energy that it gets from its star. So if you see oxygen, you can be pretty sure that there's a life form that's making that oxygen, probably out of water like the plants do on Earth. And then you'll be saying that there's a biosphere out there. There's something alive. And I think it's probably the best bet we have of discovering interesting life elsewhere in the galaxy, other than just possibly by it sort of like shouting at us on radio waves. But they ain't done that yet. we get better at listening, but I do think it's very exciting that we will soon have the ability to look for that sort of sign of life.
I agree. I find it fascinating that telescopes or something analogous to telescopes can detect these things.
There are three big telescopes being built at the moment, or being designed at the moment, which between them will have more capacity to gather light than all the telescopes since Galileo. People are used to the idea that computers increase in power on an exponential rate, but they forget that all sorts of other technologies, to some extent because they're helped by computer design, do that too. So astronomy is a good example. The capability of telescopes is going up at an extraordinary rate. Or X-ray studies, the brilliance of X-rays goes up much faster than the processing power of computers and has been doing so longer. There's an extraordinary amount of technological progress in the world that we don't tend to notice because it's mostly being used by guys in labs.
Mm-hmm. We also, I think, don't tend to notice some things that become, once you point them out, become obvious, like how climate change is altering plants. You taught me about stomata counting. Mm-hmm. Now explain it to the rest.
referring to this a little bit earlier. The stomata are wonderful little things. They're basically plant nostrils. They're the ways in which plants take in carbon dioxide. And gas exchange being what it is, taking in plant carbon dioxide also means losing water because it basically you're opening a hole in the outside part of the plant. And so by and large, plants don't like losing water, but carbon dioxide is what they eat. So the stomata are involved in this continuous balancing act between not losing too much water and taking in enough carbon dioxide. It's a fascinating little story. But if you increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the world outside, then plants need fewer stomata. And not having been born yesterday, in fact having been born hundreds of millions of years ago, plants say, well, fewer stomata then. And so if you look at the stomata of leaves from the early 19th century and the stomata of leaves from now, you will see that there are more stomata on the leaves of the early 19th century because they needed to get in more carbon dioxide. Now there are fewer, so you can actually see this. You can trace this in time. Some people try to use that to go much further back in time to try and measure carbon dioxide levels in the distant geological past, which raises other questions. But this then leads to this fact that plants change the way they use water when you change the amount of carbon dioxide they have, and that's an important thing about plants. And the fact that carbon dioxide is food for plants means that there are lots of these second-order things going on when you increase the carbon dioxide level. What's slightly unfortunate is that it doesn't seem as though it's enough, as it were. Some people have argued that because carbon dioxide is plant food, then the more carbon dioxide we have in the atmosphere, the more the plants will grow, they'll take away the carbon dioxide. It's not actually that simple. Not only that, although carbon dioxide does increase the yields of some crops, it doesn't do so as much as you might hope. And there are some worries that it changes the balance of protein to carbohydrate in a crop and things like that. So these are the sorts of issues that we need to be thinking about, but not in any way to minimize the fact we also need to be thinking about the fact that the world is warming up.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you then to say something as well about the effect of nitrogen? You point out that roughly 2% of our energy is now used on fixing nitrogen, in other words, manufacturing it to apply to crops to get these results that we think are good results. But the effect, in some ways, again, has been anything but benign.
Well, the nitrogen cycle is, if you like, it's humanity's first attempt to actually take one of these great biogeochemical cycles and run with it, take control of it. We need nitrogen because we need protein, and to make protein, plants need nitrogen, and plants can't fix nitrogen themselves, so you have to put nitrogen into the soil or encourage microorganisms in the soil to nitrogen in the form of nitrates to the plants. And we've actually been remarkably successful on this. You would not be able to provide anything like the amount of protein that we currently provide to the people of the planet without significant amounts of nitrate fertilizer, and also, though it's not a very efficient or pleasant way to do it, the nitrates that come out of car exhausts also probably help with this a fair amount. There's just a lot of environmental nitrogen around. But there are real worries that nitrogen runoffs have various different harmful environmental effects. And it's also true that, you know, nitrogen is something, it takes an awful lot of energy to fix all that nitrogen. So nitrogen cycle is our first attempt to have a sort of industrial biogeochemical cycle. And it hasn't gone disastrously wrong, but it's certainly worth bearing in mind as we realize that, you know, the carbon cycle, which is a much bigger and much more urgent thing, is coming under the same... We're having to talk about the same level of control over that.
Yes, you make the point that we could only feed about half as many people as arable land on the planet can provide now. I mean, half...
Without the nitrogen. At the moment, it
seems
partly
amazing.
How we choose to do it. I mean, if many more of us were vegetarians, then we would be able to do this better. But at the moment, yes, there are calculations that suggest that about 40% of the nitrogen that's in the protein that you eat has passed through a nitrate factory, which is a sobering thought. But it's certainly much, much better than mass starvation.
Yes. Well, I don't want us to keep sounding unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
But I want you to say something, if you can, about the change of land use and how this has changed the atmosphere. I mean, particularly the water content of the atmosphere, because I think we talk about planting trees and think, oh, that's fine. But obviously plants are more complicated than we've
Absolutely.
Made out.
Planting trees, this is an interesting thing. It's very hard to actually get a strong sense of quite to get a strong handle. I mean, not just hard for lay people like you and I, but also hard for practicing scientists to get a full handle on what's going on here. But by and large, grasses use less water. They emit less water to the atmosphere. So by and large, if you clear a forest and plant a prairie instead, you are going to dry out the atmosphere above you. And that's something that we've been doing on quite a large scale. I mean, there's something like five times as much arable land on the planet as there was in 1700. And so that has a big effect. And very hard to actually measure that effect because it's continuous and it's rather hard to capture in models. But there's some sort of like first order calculations that suggest it's sort of the same as the effect of it's sort of similar in terms of magnitude as an El Nino. And this is nothing to do with carbon dioxide. This is a change in water patterns. Now, whether it actually has the same impact as an El Nino is something that's really hard to answer. But in terms of the energy, the change in energy with either evaporating the water or not, that's roughly an El Nino-sized thing. And no one sat down to try and think about whether we should do that, but that's one of the things we've done. The interesting thing is that it does look as though plants have done such things sort of, as it were, on their own. There are the spread of grasses over the last 20 million years is a very interesting thing. There were very, very few grasses until about 30 million years ago, and open prairie-type grasses only start around then. And they only really, really take off something like 8 million years ago. And there's a theory that they do this almost by conspiracy, by being better at burning and using less water. So they spread, they burn down the forest, they spread into the ex-forest, they then dry out the environment, then that causes more fire, that causes more dead forests. And that you can see, and it's particularly clear in northern India, but also in East Africa, that forest biosystems were wiped away by the grass over relatively short periods of time by geological sands. And so possible that that's actually also part of the human story, and that that's where the savannas of East Africa come from.
So can you say clearly how ambiguous it is, how ambivalent maybe we should feel about planting a tree to offset a carbon cost? I mean, you mentioned rainforests and the liability that they face if weather becomes dry or they don't get the rain, they're going to die. There's then other things. And do we just put another tree in that place?
Well, there are various things. Trees take time to grow. So if you're emitting a ton of carbon and planting a tree that's going to weigh a ton, or in fact rather more than a ton when everything's taken into account, in 20 years' time, then you're cheating. You're basically getting 20 years free until you're emitting your carbon now, you're storing it up later. That's not very good. The other thing is that in general, the amount of good we can do by planting trees is quite limited compared to the amount of harm we do by burning fossil fuels. I mean, if you reforested the entire world, you still wouldn't actually solve the problem. And you'd also find that we weren't growing any any crops anymore, and it's kind of hard to commute, what with all the trees in the way. So I've got nothing against... There's also, interestingly, a theoretical argument, just that trees are darker than grasslands, and thus all other things being equal will absorb somewhat more sunlight. There's an argument that, you know, in some absolute sense, trees don't do much to offset the problem unless you plant them in northern, high northern latitudes. Have I got that right? Possibly the other way around. The point is that there are a lot of complexities about this. I don't think anyone, I don't have any problem with planting a tree in a good place. And I accept that it's what, if you plant a tree that you would absolutely not have planted, there is a certain amount of substitution there. There again, if you find a way to fund someone to use biomass energy in a rather cleaner way than they are now by not burning dung on an open stove in a small hut, but actually having a rather more efficient fire, you're probably doing more human good. You know, you can do carbon offsetting if you do things that genuinely wouldn't have been done otherwise, but it's very hard to say what would have been done otherwise. It's not a, certainly not a substitute for moving us in general ways to carbon-free energy technologies. That's got to be the way to go in the long run.
Well, let me briefly, to close, return to what we were saying at the beginning, that scientists, individuals, are the answer to all this. But you also make the point at the beginning of the book that when scientists were trying to discover the process of photosynthesis, they often got things wrong. And it sort of haunts the whole book, the idea that are we getting things right, are we getting things wrong? Do you think that we can use climate change models? Can we rely on them? How do we know we're going down the right path sometimes, or shouldn't we have to care?
I think it's very interesting the two words you choose. Can we use climate models? Absolutely, certainly. Can we rely on them? Rather less so. I mean, we have to be informed about them. We have to both... The research community has to take them seriously and try and make them better. The non-research community, you know, the rest of us, we have to think about them and think critically about what they're claiming. But there's no real way of understanding what the climate on the Earth with 800 parts per million of carbon dioxide as opposed to today's 400 million parts per million of carbon dioxide. There's no real way of understanding that without a model. Now, the models may be wrong. There are lots of things the models don't capture, but I think that there's a real good faith effort going on in the scientific community to improve the models in a lot of different ways. And they also may be helped by the great increase in computing power. I mean, there are people out there who already are talking about computers 100 times faster than the fastest being used for climate today within the next 5 years. So I don't think climate models are not a solution. They're a very helpful way of looking at the answer. But, you know, even if we never ran another climate model, we already know enough to say less carbon in the atmosphere, that would be a good thing. You know, I sometimes worry as a journalist and as a writer that we get into the finer details, and it's very easy to miss those big facts like less carbon dioxide being emitted now, good, a lot less, very good. So that's really the bottom line.
But you are optimistic. I mean, considering the technicals and the prognostications that you have to deal with, you've written a very cheerful book. I mean, I must say that even ancient religions that believed in sun worship seem to be more reasonable.
Well, there are two things. I'm endlessly buoyed up by both by the twin facts of how remarkably interesting the world we live in is and how inspiring it is that people can discover those interesting things. That makes me happy all the time. I'm not actually by nature a very optimistic person, but I'm very influenced by friends of mine who've thought about this and who point out that by and large being optimistic is better than the alternative. I could tell you that, as there are people out there who can tell you, that there is no way that we will escape a century of pain and suffering and death. But I don't think that saying that is very... I think there's a chance that taking a clear-eyed but optimistic view will help. I don't think taking a defeatist view has really any chance of helping at all. So I think there's a certain amount of what the Italian Marxist Gramsci used to talk about when he said, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. I mean, optimists are much more likely to save the world in this respect, I think, than pessimists.
Well, it's been very helpful talking to you, Oliver. Thank you very, very much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Oliver Morton is now news editor with the journal Nature. His latest book is Eating the Sun. Highly recommended. He was with Michelle Field in London. Next week, something related in a way, why crops in Africa aren't growing. Could it be that they are starved for science? Robert Pahlberg in Boston makes a compelling case. Meanwhile, don't miss Catalyst coming up on ABC Television in 2 minutes with a remarkable story about London, energy and what could be a revolution. That's ABC Television at 8. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.